welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic today, Tim. Our guest really opened up this topic of what is notorious now, this unsolved pop culture murder that has gone down into generations at this point. And we go back in time a little bit here, and it feels like a nostalgic trip. And I appreciate that. And I want to say that we learned so much more in this interview about this topic because this guy has done so much work on it. And back in the day when it happened, we didn't have all of the resources that we have now to get the information. But Tim, I'm going on and on. People don't know what I'm talking about yet. Let's talk about you and your mood. How are you?
I'm doing great today. Thanks a lot. I'm very excited to introduce this conversation that we had with filmmaker and podcaster and journalist Don Sikorski. And Don has put together a podcast called The Dossier, and it's from Criminal Minded Media, and it is about Chris Wallace, or the notorious B.I.G., and his murder. He was murdered in 1997 in Los Angeles at the age of 24 years old. So we go over his murder and talk about Don's podcast, The Dossier, which is really diving deep and really trying to uncover who killed Biggie.
Who killed Biggie and why? And if Biggie was actually the intended target for this hit. And this, of course, isn't just about Biggie. This expands into the whole hip-hop culture of the time, Tupac, etc. It is really this exploration of what happened culturally at that time. And again, it's very interesting to go back in time and think about where you were at when you heard these songs, when you heard Tupac, when you heard Biggie for the first time, when you heard Snoop, like that whole genre of music that you were introduced to if you weren't in that culture. And it hit that mainstream. And it's a really poignant reflection on, I guess, your youth if you're in that age range.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting story. I hope you all enjoy this interview with Don, and make sure to check out his podcast, The Dossier, which is still airing now. Let us know what you think on social media at Crawlspace Podcast or Crawlspace Pod.
And Tim, if people wanted to hear this episode along with about a million other episodes of the shows that we've done without the commercials, where would one travel via the internet to do so?
Well, our good listeners can now subscribe to Crawlspace Premium on Apple Podcasts right there in the app. But if you're not an Apple user, you can go to crawlspace.supportingcast.fm and sign up for the same product there. You get early releases, ad-free episodes, and our bonus show that everybody loves. So make sure to check that out.
All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back with Don Sikorski.
How's it going, everyone? It's Tim and Lance here. Have you ever wanted someone to read you creepy bedtime stories in the most velvety voice ever?
Well, you had me hooked at velvety, Tim. We are excited to share a podcast that is exactly that. It's called Nighty Night Bedtime Stories to Keep You Awake. And Tim, it's narrated by a friend of ours.
That's right. New York Times bestselling author and podcaster Rabia Chaudhry. Nighty Night is an anthology featuring classic horror stories this season and fictionalized true life stories in season one that are so creepy that you will realize reality is scarier than fiction.
And Tim, I know our favorite part of each episode is at the end when Rabia says, but wait, there's more to the story. And we get to hear those fascinating details about the author and the context of the tale. What's your favorite episode?
My favorite episode is The Tiny Hairs from season one, which takes us on a harrowing journey when the narrator runs into a dangerous man in the woods. What about you?
Well, mine comes from the current season. It's called The Horla, in which we witness the protagonist spiral into a descent of madness. Tim, I feel like I'm constantly spiraling into a descent of madness, so I really relate to that one.
Well, I hear that. So dim your lights, get under a cozy blanket, and find and subscribe to Nighty Night wherever you get your podcasts.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Welcome to the podcast, Don Sikorski. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you guys?
Yeah, we're doing very well today and really excited to speak with you and to, first of all, just say well done on taking on one of today's most notorious unsolved murders in pop culture. Added on to that, it must have been a daunting task. But before we get to that, can you let the audience know who you are and a little bit about your background?
Yeah, so my name obviously is Don Sikorski. Upon graduating from NYU, I graduated with a degree in journalism. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. And what was funny is at that time, this is roughly the early 2000s, there was a rumor in New York City that the NYPD had a secret task force that was going after crimes within the hip hop music business. And as a young journalist and then filmmaker, I said, this is pretty interesting. I went up to B&H in New York City, which is this famous camera store. I bought a camera. And for the next 3 years, I sort of went into the underbelly of hip hop and tried to understand why the NYPD, the FBI, and the U.S. Attorney's Office was doing these sort of hardcore hip hop crime investigations, right? And that film came out through Universal. It was called Rap Sheet, Hip Hop and the Cops. And not to get long-winded, but all of my work and my career, sort of that was the origin story of it, right? And within hip hop, what you have is you have a lot of cops and robbers stories. You have a lot of, you know, what was considered at that time, a lot of the sort of underworld drug figures from the 80s in New York City and Los Angeles found their way inside hip hop. And to me, it was always what these stories have always been is a criminal justice story, right? It's about policing. It's about a musical culture in hip hop that now you could argue is the most popular form of music and pop culture. So all of those elements for me, you know, have always been the ingredients for great storytelling. And at that time, obviously, I sort of started to ingest all of the information around the murders of Biggie and Tupac, because if you have a secret unit that is looking at this, it begs the question, well, if they have this secret unit, why are literally in hip hop, I think their murder clearance rate is non-existent. You know, you can go back to all of the murders that have transpired within hip hop, and they've only solved like 20% of them, right? With Tupac and Biggie being the biggest of them all.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow, that's really interesting. So, okay, so you went, you kind of ingrained yourself in the community, made this movie, and had a lot of information. And how did you get, I guess, FBI files?
So that's a great story. And for me, when I decided to do this podcast, the reason why I did this is I personally felt at the time that the stories of Biggie and Tupac had been done to death, right? And I was hired by Fox to do a special on Fox Network called Who Shot Biggie and Tupac? And what was fascinating about it is as an executive producer, they gave me access to a lot of lawyers, a lot of private investigators, and I was getting a lot of these sort of, for lack of a better word, data dumps from researchers. And within one of these data dumps, I saw a name that was an FBI agent, and his name was Phil Carson. And I said, that's interesting. You know, an FBI agent looked at this case. He's got to be still around. It seems like he's a young guy. But at the time in my research, I knew he was also still within the FBI. And when people are still within the FBI, the percentages of them talking to you are very low, especially about a case they worked. I was able to get a few phone numbers, and I was able to get an email. And I made a blind phone call, and Phil Carson, the FBI agent, answers the phone. And I said, hey, man, I'm looking into this. I saw your name. And the response I got on the other end of the phone was from an individual who sounded like he was holding on to a story for about 15 years, which he was. And that story was that he was the only FBI agent to be assigned to look into the murder of Biggie. And secondarily to that, he told me he solved the murder and it was completely shut down by the powers that be within the LAPD, within the U.S. Attorney's Office, but not, funny enough, within the FBI. The FBI was very supportive of his investigation. Now, the second part of this, I do have to protect the source. In the midst of all of this investigation, I got two sources. One of them was a gentleman by the name of Sergio Robledo. And Sergio Robledo was the private detective for the Wallace family when they sued the city of Los Angeles. The other source will remain nameless, but with between these two sources, I was given all of the civil trial documents, which are under federal seal, meaning no one had ever saw them. And I also was able to get the unredacted FBI files of Phil Carson's investigative case. Now, what that provides you as a journalist is a roadmap and proof in black and white within FBI and LAPD files of what went on. It's not just a person telling you, hey, I solved this case, right? It's not a person telling you, because a lot of times what happens in law enforcement, these guys get disgruntled, right? They have an axe to grind. And for the first 6 months with Phil, I kind of was trying to figure out, man, what's this fucking guy's angle here, right? Is there something that is more than meets the eye? And cut to years later now, what I do know is Phil Carson might be one of the most forthright law enforcement officers I've ever worked with. And second to that, it was backed up by documented proof within these files and documents. So that's a home run. And so what I said as a filmmaker, as a journalist, as a TV producer now, I said, I don't want anyone to tell me how to tell this story. And I will say this, it's the only time in my career that I was allowed to write and produce something without somebody telling me, hey, Don, you got to change this. We got to fucking do this. We got to go talk to the lawyers about this. And the dossier really is the story of Phil Carson. It's the story of a time within Los Angeles, within the Los Angeles police departments, that tells a story of about 15 years of a broken system, of a broken city, and a broken police department. And that's the story I really wanted to tell.
I find it so remarkable that you're able to call Phil Carson and he immediately picks up and you're able to have this dialogue with him, and there's just something about the way he's speaking that tells you he needs to tell this story. What was it about you that he realized this is the guy that all of this pent up info is going to be delivered to?
You know, I don't know that, but I will tell you a funny anecdote is when I got him on the phone. Now, just think about how crazy I am in this moment. When I got him on the phone, he's an active FBI agent, and I recorded the call. Because I didn't think that maybe I would ever get him on the telephone again. And I wanted something, whatever he said, to be documented, right? Because he was finding a piece of this story that no one had. Everyone had gone through this story and almost picked it apart like a vulture. And, you know, for me, what I said to him is, I think it was two things. Is one, for some reason, he trusted me. And then the second is, I think he looked into my background and he saw the work that I had done. And I think he said, all right, this guy's track record looks pretty good. Let me give him a shot. Now, listen, that one phone call translated into hundreds of meetings with him, right? In person, at hotels, at his house, in parking lots. Like, this was not something, you know, that was like happened overnight. But he did get to a point where he trusted me to tell his story. And let's be honest about it. His story was going after very powerful people. You know, when you start talking about chiefs of police, when you start talking about U.S. attorneys, right? When you start talking about the infrastructure of the city of Los Angeles, this is pretty heavy stuff, right? This is stuff that even Sergio Robledo, who, you know, came out of South Bureau Homicide for the LAPD, right? Hired by the Wallace family. He even said to me at a certain point when I found Phil, he said, "Don, you should really be careful. You know, you're kind of rustling trees and environments of some very powerful people." Now, coming from Sergio, who was this decorated LAPD homicide detective, you know, who had seen it all, had been around for Rodney King, had been around for some of the darkest days of the LAPD. Him saying that to me, I said, and I'll never forget where I was. I'm not from Los Angeles. I was in the Valley in LA at that time. And he said, "You know, where are you staying? Do you look around when you go to the parking lot of the hotel you're at? Do you, you know, are you aware of, you know, who's around you?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, I had done some stuff prior to that that, you know, allowed me to understand if you go after powerful people, they could fuck with you, right?" So I think in a long-winded way to answer your question, I gained Phil's trust and I gained Sergio's trust for them to see that I wanted to just tell the truth, right? And that's been the biggest casualty in this story is just the truth for Miss Wallace and the Wallace family. And the truth that exists, like, as I like to say it, it's hiding in plain sight, which is the worst type of truth.
Right. Wow. Really interesting stuff. I know we mentioned Los Angeles and sort of the little bit of the history of the culture of the LAPD at that time. But I'm curious about Notorious B.I.G.'s impact on the culture and on you to tell this story. Who is Chris Wallace to you? And what was like hearing Biggie's music like for you?
Yeah, so my experience was very unique in a sense that I grew up playing basketball. And I played college basketball at NYU. And so when I go to NYU in my freshman year, you know, 1994, New York City, that was the soundtrack really of my first as a kid who grew up in Connecticut, moves to downtown, you know, Greenwich Village, and everyone on the basketball team is listening to, you know, his first album, Ready to Die. They're listening to Nas. They're listening to, you know, Wu-Tang. They're listening to basically what is the golden era of hip hop at that time. And, you know, for me also is just walking the streets of New York. It was the soundtrack that you heard in cars, right? That you heard at the West 4th basketball playground, or you heard up at Rucker in Harlem. So the combination of me being in New York City as a young kid, right, who grew up sort of in Connecticut, about an hour and a half outside of, you know, New York City, hadn't spent that much time. That was really my soundtrack of college, you know, and that to me, you know, that music and that era just brings me back to, you know, your early college days, which if you had fun is sort of a defining time in your life. It was the time that I decided to become a journalist, you know. Up until that point, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I was lucky to get into NYU. Basketball afforded me that experience and I took advantage of it.
Yeah, I think just hearing you say that and remembering that time period where those artists were so huge, and it was the first time that a genre of music crossed over cultures, where you mentioned being in Connecticut. I grew up in New Hampshire, but we all heard the same music coming out of the same cars when they're pulling up to high school, and these aren't people who look like the artists. You know, these are not the same neighborhoods that these artists grew up in. I'm wondering, like, how much of that sunk in for you at the time? Because personally, it didn't really sink in for me at the time. And but looking back on it, like how influential it was, but that crossing into your culture, what, how did that feel?
Well, I always tell this story. And again, you know, a lot of times I get asked, like, why did you go and look at this stuff? And what I still don't know in a real way, but I will tell a story that I think defines it, is growing up in Connecticut when I was playing basketball. That's all I did, is I played basketball, right? So when I was with the basketball team, I had a station wagon, a Chevy Caprice that could hold like 12 people in it. And literally we would be the basketball team and the kids would put in a Wu-Tang cassette. They would put in a Biggie cassette. They would put in what that music was, and being around them and playing basketball, sort of, I went into those neighborhoods. I went and played basketball in the places where, if I'm being honest, I was the sort of the only white kid, right? And then what's funny about it is when I went back to my neighborhood where I grew up with, which was like an immigrant community of like Italian kids and Greek kids, they're playing Rush and Led Zeppelin and classic rock, you know? So that dichotomy for me, I always saw at a very young age because of my love of playing basketball, playing AAU, And I think it's had a defining effect, you know, if you look at my career in terms of wanting to tell stories, not just the Biggie story, but stories that go into, you know, policing, mass incarceration, police corruption, socioeconomic issues that affects all of these neighborhoods throughout America, and the dialogue that we keep having around this.
That was a great answer to the question. It really puts a lot of things into perspective when you have the clear answer to some like vague question like that. So appreciate that.
Yeah, it is. It's had me think about that a lot because of a lot of what I've done in my career. I've often thought about that. And the other piece of it I will tell you that I think is fascinating is I had another friend of mine who growing up had John Gotti posters on his wall, you know? So I'm like listening to hip hop. He's obsessed with John Gotti and John Gotti's story, and his poster is in his, you know, bedroom. So I think like the dichotomy of hip hop music and the John Gotti in my best friend's bedroom is boils down in a reductive way a lot of what I've been fascinated with in storytelling.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Thanks to our sponsors. And now we're back to the program. All right. Well, I know in your podcast, there is so much information. And I just want to sort of ask about the very beginning here. How was Chris Wallace murdered? Where and when?
So Chris Wallace is at a after party for Vibe magazine that he, funny enough, didn't really want to go. You know, Sean Puffy Combs at the time, you know, sort of dragged him there. At that party, it was a celebratory mood because his new album was coming out. They're at the party. There's a lot of different characters at the party that we now know. There's Crips and Bloods. There's, you know, off-duty LAPD officers, on-duty LAPD officers, celebrities from Leonardo DiCaprio to Shaq to, this is a Hollywood party. They come out of this party and they are in a caravan of cars. Puffy's in a car, Biggie is in a car, and they have a number of security people that are with them. A number of those security officers that are with them that night are actually police officers. They're Long Beach police officers, they're LA County Sheriff's police officers, and then they're security for Biggie and Puffy, specifically an individual named Eugene Deal, who becomes very important in this story. They pull out of the Peterson Automotive Museum, and here's where it gets interesting. is in the first car is Puffy, in the second car is Biggie and a number of people, and Eugene Deal is in the car with Puffy. And Eugene Deal had been told prior to that party not to go to the party, that there was something going on, that either Puffy or Biggie could be killed. And Gene Deal communicated that to Puffy, and he didn't listen. Puffy is in that vehicle, and Gene Deal tells the driver to run the red light, to not stop at that red light. And this becomes important later on. Biggie and his crew pull up, and they stop at the red light. Parked to the left of them is the Chevy Impala. An arm reaches out and fires the shots that kill Biggie. You know, he's taken to Cedar Sinai. They try and revive him, but for lack of a better words, he, you know, passes away at the hospital, or probably was dead before he got to the hospital. But that is the sort of rough summary of how he's shot and killed that night, with a lot of other backstory within it.
As a journalist receiving unredacted files, you said you had unredacted files. How did that even become a possibility in this case?
Well, here's the thing. There's always been certain files that have existed, and if I could break it down for you, I'll tell you the three, for lack of a better word, groups of files, right? The first batch of files, and Randall Sullivan, the journalist who's done incredible work on this story, he was given Russell Poole's files, and Russell Poole was the original LAPD robbery homicide detective, was spot on in what he was investigating, but was shut down by the LAPD. So Randall has those files. The Poole family have those files. I saw some of those files and used some of those for the dossier. The second tranche of files are what I like to call the Sergio Robledo, or more importantly, the Wallace family civil trial files. And what those files are was when the Wallace family sued the LAPD and the city of Los Angeles for wrongful death, they had discovery, and the LAPD had to give the Wallace family lawyers all of their internal files on the murder and homicide investigation. Okay. And then lastly, you have what I like to call the FBI files and the Phil Carson investigative files, which shows from point A to point B who committed the murder, who covered it up, and why. And between these three tranches of documents, you can really tell a pretty incredible story, right? And for me, the most important files, I think, are the Wallace family files, and I'll tell you why, is other than myself, the only people that are allowed to have those files are the city of Los Angeles and the Wallace family lawyers. It is illegal for me to have those files. Those files are under a federal seal by a federal judge in the federal court in Los Angeles. I don't have a problem saying that I have those documents, because there's truth in those documents that's been ignored by the city of Los Angeles. So I would love for them to come after me and try and, you know, charge me with having these documents. And then lastly is the Phil Carson files, which kind of just puts the icing on the top of the cake of what exactly happened. And the reason for that is, if you think about the FBI, this is our top investigative body in our country. The FBI can run, you know, financials with bank accounts. They can run wiretaps to listen to everyone. They can go into police departments, which they did in the LAPD, and demand investigative files. And they also can go to confidential sources, confidential informants, and procure information in a way that a lot of people can't, because it's the FBI. And if you lie to the FBI, you're going to go to jail, and people are scared of the FBI, right? So for me as a journalist, these files became immensely important in the blueprint of the dossier, because it wasn't just me saying these things. I'm referencing files that have file numbers that are there in black and white.
Right. And just to clarify, why are you inviting them to come after you because you have the sealed files?
Because I think, you know, the city of Los Angeles, the LAPD, and the United States Attorney's Office within Los Angeles lied. They covered up, you know, evidence that is blatant. They bullied people across the board, including Phil Carson. And I think at a certain point, you would want justice for the Wallace family, for the involvement of LAPD officers in the murder of Biggie.
Can I back it up a little bit and just ask what's probably an obvious question?
Sure.
What was it about the murders that brought the FBI in the first place? Why didn't it just stay a Los Angeles or a regional thing?
It's an interesting story, and one I think you'll be surprised about. So what I started to realize with Phil Carson is Phil Carson traditionally worked as within the LA field office around public corruption. Now, the reason Phil Carson gets to Biggie is very simple. Is Phil Carson first is the FBI agent that looks into a police scandal called the Rampart Police Scandal. And the Rampart Police Scandal involves a crew of dirty police officers that includes David Mack, Rafael Perez, Nino Durden, Kevin Gaines, and a slew of others. So he does that investigation, and what he realizes is that the LAPD is containing the amount of dirty officers within the Rampart Police Division. And he goes to his bosses and he goes to the LAPD and he says, what the fuck are you guys doing here? I have a list of dirty officers here and you're not allowing me to look into these guys. And he shut down at that point, right? Now on that list of officers is a guy by the name of Ruben Palomares, right? Now what Ruben Palomares is doing is even more interesting than the murder of Biggie and Rampart. He's in bed with the Sinaloa drug cartel. And he's robbing drug stash houses across South Central Los Angeles and splitting the money and the drugs with an operative within the Sinaloa drug cartel. And Phil investigates that case and he sees the same patterns and practices of the LAPD sort of, you know, managing this wide swath of corruption without any sort of, for lack of a better word, consequences. And he's like, Jesus, this is unbelievable. He's at home after he has done both of those investigations and he's watching a VH1 special. Phil Carson does not know hip hop. He does not know Biggie. He could give a shit about that. But he watches this VH1 special and he goes, I know what the fuck is going on here. This is all tied to Rampart. This is all tied to the dirty Rampart cops. And guess what? I'm the best possible person to go after this case because I just did these two investigations. He goes to his bosses and in the FBI, it's kind of funny. It's like you're pitching a fucking story. He's like, come on, guys, let me do this. His bosses are like, go with God. Go ahead. And he opens this investigation. So if you really think about that, it's pretty staggering in that he wasn't this guy who was like, oh, fuck, this is like this celebrity case. I got to go after it, right? There was precedent-setting cases prior to Biggie that he saw all of these players, and he's like, oh, okay, I know what the fuck's going on here, and there you have it.
Wow, so Phil Carson kind of got involved because he felt like he had an angle or like the perspective of more than one case that that could help. Wow, that's really interesting. So does this connect to Tupac before Biggie?
So I will say this about Tupac that I think is vastly interesting is Suge Knight made a statement in the first season of The Dossier. And he said, if you solve one, you solve the other, right? And again, I say, you take what Suge says with a grain of salt. He said many things to misdirect people many times over the years. But I think there's something to that. And secondarily to that, there's an individual LAPD officer named Kevin Gaines. Now, Kevin Gaines was dating, was sleeping with Suge Knight's wife. Kevin Gaines at certain points was taken out to the desert by Suge Knight and sort of undressed physically and, you know, for lack of a better word, psychologically saying, you stay away from, you know, my wife, blah, blah, blah. Kevin Gaines was, you know, friends with David Mack, with Rafael Perez. Kevin Gaines at times worked security for Snoop Dogg, right? It is rumored that Kevin Gaines is the one who removed evidence. If you remember when Snoop Dogg went on trial for murder and evidence disappeared, Kevin Gaines is the one who removed that evidence. Now, lastly, to get to Tupac, Kevin Gaines was in Las Vegas on the night that Tupac was shot and killed. Now, I will say this. Suge has pretty much said Keefe D has nothing to do with the killing of Tupac. Orlando Anderson, who everyone thought was the trigger man, has nothing to do with the killing of Tupac or the shooting of me. Suge was there. He said this. You can go read it. Listen to it, blah, blah, blah. So as a regards to Tupac and Biggie, I think there is a case that I'm starting to connect that also puts LAPD officer Kevin Gaines and maybe others in Vegas the night that Tupac is killed, okay? And I'm not going to state it as a fact. I'm going to state it as it's something that, for me, having concentrated on the corruption of the LAPD and the Biggie investigation that I'm starting to look into now. I'm now trying to get files on Kevin Gaines as best as I can and understand, you know, is there a there? And I think to me, that's the most interesting part of this quote unquote resurfacing of this Tupac, you know, story that now has become, you know, big in the media, right? Because Keefe D is going to go to trial. I think it's very convenient for the Las Vegas Police Department to put a bow on a case that has been a black eye to their department in that city for a very long time. And Keefe D is an easy target. So I'll leave it at that. And I think it'll continue. The story will continue to grow. As I said before, you know, Suge Knight has started to do his own podcast. And has started to talk about some of this stuff, which I find interesting at this particular time. So that's a story that I think will keep evolving and keep going on.
Right. And is the story of Tupac and Keefe D getting indicted, is that all coincidental with the release of your podcast, The Dossier?
It was completely, you know, just by chance. You know, as we started to put out season two, that news broke, and having enough knowledge, and also there's a particular individual that's done a lot of work around the Tupac investigation, and he's a journalist named RJ Bond. So what I decided to do in season two is we do have a set number of episodes devoted to, you know, the continuation of the cover up of the LAPD. But we're doing some bonus episodes that kind of keeps track of this Tupac stuff from an angle of how are these two things connected? Let's explain to the audience some weird connections here early on that we're continuing to look into.
Got to hand it to you for breaking it down like that so articulately, because it was a very dense case, right? These are very, it's got a lot of details here, so really appreciate you being so clear about all of those details. And I'm curious, has any other journalist aside from yourself gone this deep? Has any other journalist gone this deep in this?
Well, I think there's a case to be made that Randall Sullivan, the work that he's done in two of his books, one being the book Labyrinth, which is basically Russell Poole's story. And then the follow-up to that, Randall Solomon's going to kill me. It's basically the sequel to Labyrinth. And then, you know, one of my dear friends, Brad Furman, directed a movie, and I produced a movie called City of Lies with Johnny Depp and Forest Whitaker. And in the course of doing that movie with Johnny Depp, where Johnny Depp plays Russell Poole, Forest Whitaker plays a journalist, Brad and myself were also able to sort of attain information, attain, you know, knowledge, because when you do a big time Hollywood, you know, film, you know, people are apt to speak to you because they think there's a pot of gold at the end of the Hollywood rainbow, right? And that's another part of this story. As we're doing the dossier, we're sort of in production on City of Lies, and there was a lot of, and Sergio was a tech advisor on that Hollywood movie, and so Sergio's floating around, and he's feeding us information, he's letting us watch, you know, depositions and talking to us about all of this stuff. So this story, in a sense, the timing of it has been, you know, in life sometimes you can't, you know, timing is everything. And this all sort of came together at that moment. But as far as like, I would love, and I've encouraged or tried to like tell some young journalists, like, hey, why don't you look into this stuff, right? Hey, why don't you like, do some work the way I did. But Randall comes to mind. I might be missing some others, but that to me, Randall is the one who has done a tremendous amount of research and investigation. And he's very close with Perry Sanders, who Perry was the Wallace family lawyer. And so Perry was able to give Randall some information, if you will.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Thanks to our sponsors. And now we're back to the program. Wow, interesting stuff. Is Phil Carson still active FBI?
No, so that was the part of the story is when I called him that original phone call, he said, you know, your timing's impeccable. I'm about to retire in, you know, 2 months and then I'll talk to you. So Phil Carson never really talked to me while he was in the FBI. He's a very by the book agent. So once he retired is when we really sat down and started to talk about this stuff and start to get his full story, which is incredible. And it's taken me, you know, a number of years now to realize one thing about Phil is there is not a thing that he has told me or said to me or gone on the record about that he can't prove. He's not someone that's hyperbolic. He's not somebody who is exaggerating anything. And the reason for that is he believes that this case will be reopened by the FBI and the U.S. attorney at a certain point. So he does not want to do anything to jeopardize that. Whatever information he releases or we release to the public, you know, could be called on the mat in any proceeding legally or otherwise.
Wow. Who wouldn't want the case reopened by the FBI?
Well, I think the LAPD would not want the case reopened. You know, what's interesting about reopening the case is I think there would have to be a mea culpa on behalf of not only the LAPD, but the city attorney at the time that this has gone on. And lastly, sort of the U.S. attorney's office, who could have brought Phil Carson's case, could have signed off in doing that case and didn't. You know, I think the LAPD does not want this to come out. Ironically enough, within documents that I have and specific documents, the time of the cover-up and when this is going on, there's a name that is listed inside of these documents as some of the, for lack of a better word, LAPD upper management that knew about information that LAPD officers were involved in the murder. And that is the current chief of police's name in Michael Moore, the current chief of the LAPD. So his name are on these documents. So if you just want to think about that for a second. Now, he wasn't the chief of police at the time. He was kind of, I think, a lieutenant or down further on the totem pole. But he becomes chief of police, I'm not sure what year. And funny enough, his name is listed within those documents. It took me almost a year of going through those documents and looking at names. And I'm like, holy shit, like, this Michael Moore's name is on these documents, which, you know, funny enough and ironically enough makes sense in all of this, that his name is in there. But I just thought that in a twist of fate, that's pretty interesting, right? Because it takes you present day of someone who knew this information and, you know, all these people have not told the truth.
That's wild. And what did you do to confirm that this is the same person, you know, because Michael Moore is kind of a common name?
Yes. Yeah, so I spoke to Sergio at the time, and then I confirmed with a number of people who worked inside the LAPD that was the same Michael Moore, and that was his rank at that particular, you know, time of the process of what was going on in the Biggie investigation.
And I'm going to try to do my best to articulate this question. I apologize if I fumble through it a little bit, but the statistics of performance artists like rappers and hip hop artists is so much higher than other performance artists in terms of unsolved homicides. And if you look at it, most of them, almost 100%, are shooting victims. And I'm wondering what this could do to speak to that statistic if the murders of Tupac and Biggie are solved. What does that do for that culture, and what does that say?
Well, I think what it gets to really is the national conversation or global conversation that everyone has been having about policing, right? And about the dynamics of policing in traditional areas of poverty, of socioeconomic, for lack of a better word, neighborhoods that the drug war has ravaged, right? I think it would mean a lot if the these police departments, and a lot of police departments, want to talk about reconciliation. They want to talk about transparency, right? They want to talk about cleaning up corruption, no matter where it is. And I think that if the LAPD could come forward, and I think, funny enough, if you look at the dynamic of Las Vegas and why they came forward, I personally think is look at the dynamic of Las Vegas today versus Las Vegas of 20 years ago, right? Las Vegas of 20 years ago was still, for lack of a better word, probably an insular, at least by the powers that be, racist, you know, city government, where now they have an NFL team. They want to bring the NBA into Vegas, right? They want to make Vegas this sort of global, you know, place to go. And I think the people finally within the city and within the Las Vegas PD is like, we got to clean this off our books. Now, whether they're going about it the right way, I don't know. But I think it's very important if this murder or these murders to be solved, to define that no matter what corruption has gone on, that at a certain point, the truth will come to the forefront, right? And that's what it's about. And I think in this particular case, it's just always been staggering to me the amount of evidence that exists that is in plain sight, that was ignored, that was pushed to the side, that was strategically sort of hidden, you know, from the Wallace family. And so to answer your question in a closing manner, this could mean a lot, and it could go a long way in repairing the relationship between, you know, some of these communities and some in an institution like the LAPD.
And so I guess in your opinion, is there one trigger man? Is there several people responsible here? I don't want to spoil the your podcast or anything.
No, that's fine. I mean, yeah, yes, there was one trigger man. He was a known hitman. He was, and his name is Amir Muhammad. The evidence points that Amir Muhammad was the trigger man. Amir Muhammad was best friends with LAPD David Mack. Him and David Mack had ran track at the University of Oregon. And it's pretty simple. There is a confidential informant who Phil interviewed, the LAPD interviewed, Sergio Robledo interviewed, that, you know, told the story of Amir Muhammad as being sort of a contract hitman that was hired and facilitated by Mack, possibly Rafael Perez, and leading back to Suge Knight. Now, what you have to understand about the murder of Biggie is Biggie was not supposed to be killed. Now, this goes back to the original story I told about what happens that night. The original target in that murder was Puffy, was Sean Combs. It was not Biggie. And because they ran that light, the car that stopped was the car with Big in it. If Puff stopped at that light, he would have been the target. He was the target. There's no, you know, doubt about that. Phil investigated that and knew that for a fact. So Biggie was not the target of this shooting. It was really, you know, Puff or Diddy or Love or whatever he's calling himself these days. That's who the target was.
And what made him the target?
Well, it was the ongoing back and forth between him and Suge Knight. It was the many series of sort of events that transpired. You know, I would say you could really trace it back to the fact that Puffy had a specific security individual that was with him for most of his early career. His name was Wolf Jones, and Wolf actually killed Suge's best friend in Atlanta, you know, and that was just one of the sort of spiraling effect of a series of violent incidents and back and forth. That was really as simple as that, you know, two people, two young guys, sort of warring against each other, and then different camps of guys connected to very heavy, you know, street guys, very heavy gangsters, very heavy, in Suge's case, LAPD off-duty rogue officers in the example of a David Mack, a Rafael Perez, a Kevin Gaines, a Nino Durden. You know, these were all the guys that were floating around at that time working security at Death Row. So that was really the, you know, the volatile mix that was going on at that time.
Wow, this is incredible, Don. A ton of information, and I can't wait to see where your show, The Dossier, goes. Where can people listen to it?
So The Dossier is available wherever you listen to podcasts, you know, Spotify, Apple. If you want further information, you can go to www.criminalmindedmedia.com. And that's where we have various, you know, going to do various data dumps of the documents and the evidence. And you can sort of track more information. But wherever you listen to podcasts, and now on YouTube.
Awesome. Well, yeah, thanks for joining us. And if any of the listeners hadn't listened to the podcast yet and they hear your voice, highly recommend checking out the podcast, because it's a story, again, that has so many facets and details that you just don't get in the regular mainstream media. And honestly, I think the whole subject is super interesting and fascinating, but when you start a surface level dive into it, it becomes daunting really fast. So you managed to break it down in a really great way.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I do recognize that. I will say one final thing. It is weird, I think, for anyone finding this subject matter now, because if you are to do and go into the rabbit hole, there's so many lies and misdirections that have happened in a very strategic way by many people intentionally to point in the other direction. So for me, the dossier was my way of going, this is the roadmap. Just listen to this. This is based on truth. It's based on documents and it's based on fact, right? And that was important to me to continue to do that, because any young person discovering this subject matter now or years from now will go into a rabbit hole. And what I wanted to do is just say, here's some truth. Let's look at this.